Everybody knew Basie's walk. He would walk in a room and people would know. Basie left the presence. When he left, you'd know he'd gone.
The decade of the 1930s had been good to Count Basie. Everyone knew about his band at the Reno Club in Kansas City, and audiences were waiting in line to hear him when he arrived in New York in 1936. And Basie was ready for them. With the hardest swinging band in jazz, Count Basie survived the challenges of World War II and the decline of the swing era. And by the 1950s, his renaissance was in full swing. His triumphs with Joe Williams in the 1950s helped to seal his place in the Jazz Hall of Fame. I'm Nancy Wilson. This hour, it's Count Basie's World on NPR's Jazz Profiles. For nearly 50 years, Count Basie kept a band together under his own name. Now that's quite an accomplishment, considering he outlasted two recording bands, a world war, the decline of big bands, and the British invasion of 1964, when the Beatles took over the popular music world. All, the Count kept his focus on his music and his musicians. Trumpeter Harry Sweets Edison.
When you travel together for 301 nighters, you feel close to each other. It's a family. We were with each other all the time.
For any musician, life on the road with Count Basie required sacrifice, flexibility, and the willingness to forego personal comfort. Basie drummer Butch Miles.
We were on the road in such close proximity to each other all the time that so many of us began to think alike on the stage as far as the ensemble and the Basie arrangements went. There was 18 guys in the band, vocalist 19, and our band equipment manager, 20 people, then a bus driver, but we never knew who the bus driver was because we didn't have a regular bus. You might start off the day by getting up at 6 o'clock in the morning to leave the hotel at 7 o'clock in the morning to make a 9 o'clock flight. Everybody's sitting around the airport. Then you get on the plane and you fly somewhere. Everybody's on the plane. Then you get off the plane, and many times you have to get back on a bus and travel 2 or 3 hours to the destination. Everybody goes in and gets something to eat, then you show up, then you do the show, then more often than not, you pack up, and if you were lucky enough to have a hotel, then you'd go back to the hotel, and sometimes we'd get back on the bus and drive all night. We'd do what's called a hit and run. You'd hit the town that you were going in, and then back on the bus and run to the next town. We had a lot of fun that way.
Jillian Williams, the wife of singer Joe Williams, remembered life on the bus.
The Basie bus was wonderful. I was always very cognizant of the fact that a woman on the bus is like a bump on a log, you know? That's the band's home. Having a strange woman there was really something they didn't need. They were always so tolerant. Nobody ever made me feel a nuisance. You know, I'm inflicted that on myself a bit. We had a wonderful time. We ate tuna out of the can, and it was great fun.
No matter what the conditions were for Basie and his musicians, once they hit the bandstand, they had the uncanny ability to make music that would make you tap your feet. Producer, Norman Granz.
There's a certain moment when a big band gels and comes together. Basie and I used to talk about that. It could be metronomically right in terms of its time, but it may not really be locked in so that it's really swinging hard.
By the 1930s, swing fever was sweeping the country. When Basie hit New York in 1936 with a record contract and dates at the Roseland Ballroom, audience response was chilly at first. Trumpeter Buck Clayton joined Count Basie in 1936.
Woody Herman showed us that we had a lot more to learn. Woody kind of embarrassed us in the Roseland Ballroom. They played the same number that we played and played it better than we did. So we were a little upset about that.
Basie made sure that never happened again. From NPR, I'm Nancy Wilson with a special edition of Jazz Profiles. Count Basie's World, celebrating the centennial of an American legend. This hour, the man and his music. Your host is Avery Brooks.
In 1940, Count Basie was a household name. He was surfing the tidal wave of recognition and fame.
By 1939, Basie is in the top rung of big bands, certainly among the three, four leading black bands, no question, Ellington, Lunsford, Callaway, Basie. And Basie is by far the youngest. The other three have been around much longer. But he's in that league. And he stays there.
Thanks to his stupendous cast of supporting musicians, his band was like no other. Basie had overcome the tragic death of tenor saxophonist Herschel Evans in 1939 by enlisting Texan Buddy Tate's services. The kid from Red Bank, New Jersey, had spent a decade performing, recording, and broadcasting to appreciative audiences everywhere. His life was a dream. That year, Basie recorded Going to Chicago Blues with singer Jimmy Rushing. Basie is featured here on organ.
Going to Chicago, sorry that I can't take you. Going to Chicago, sorry that I can't take you. There's nothing in Chicago that a monkey woman can do. When you see me coming, raise your window high. When you see me coming, raise your window high. When you see me passing, hang your head and cry. If you love your baby, tell the world you do. If you love your baby, tell the world you do. There's coming a day your baby really learned to love you too.
The Going to Chicago Blues was a throwback to the good old days. But times were starting to get rough for all big bands, and even the mighty Count Basie band was starting to feel the pinch of changing times.
As you got into the 40s, you had the first of two recording bans that were imposed. The American Federation of Musicians was extremely powerful. You paid attention to them because they controlled the situation. It was kind of dramatic.
The 40s brought even more dramatic change.
Yesterday, December 7th, 1941, a date which will live in infamy.
We interrupt this program to bring you a special news bulletin.
I'm Avery Brooks. Welcome to Count Basie, The Man and His Music, Part 3. This hour, we look at the life and music of Count Basie through the war years. The decline of big bands, And into his Renaissance with the New Testament bands of the 50s. Grand collaborations with the greatest singers in the world of the 60s. And his reunion with producer Norman Granz in the 70s. Count Basie was hit hard by the war, but he managed to stay active. Basie recorded the G.I. Stomp in Hollywood in June 1943. Basie's G.I. Stomp. Dan Morgenstern is the director of the Institute of Jazz Studies at Rutgers University.
During the war, they did a lot of work playing for servicemen and so on. They had good location jobs in California and in New York and in Chicago. They managed to survive maybe even better than some other bands. But then comes the crunch after the war, which has to do with changes in social habits.
Basie biographer Albert Murray.
The big thing during the war years was the USO. They played a lot of dances during the war. What hit them, of course, were those bands that lost people to the Selective Service. Buck left, Joe had to go, Lester, that pushed him over the line. It really was a traumatic experience for him.
The loss of Joe Jones and Lester Young in the same week hit Basie hard. And Basie faced other difficulties that were also hitting other big band leaders, Dan Morgenstern.
Ballroom dancing goes into decline. People move to the suburbs. Television comes in, and things become more expensive. During the war, you could cope with stuff like gasoline shortage. You could cope with it. But what happened later was that the audience went into a decline. venues started to disappear.
What was bad news for big bands turned out to be opportunity for smaller units.
Ah, yes, you heard me talk. King Cole Court is now in session. If you listen with both ears wide open, you'll hear the fractious fingering of King Cole, the guitar of Oscar Moore, and the big bass of Johnny Miller.
Trumpeter Harry Sweets Edison.
The big bands sort of diminished because dance halls diminished. Small bands began to thrive. The John Kirby Band, the Nat King Cole Trio. They had small bands. You played in clubs and it was like a concert instead of a dance.
Drummer Louis Belson.
The economic situation had a lot to do with. Prices were escalating. Travel with a big band, putting the guys on airplanes or trains and hotels and giving them their fee, it got so much, the booking agent just couldn't handle that. That kind of money wasn't around.
Pianist Oscar Peterson.
Well, I think what was happening in the 40s, believe it or not, that brought on the birth of the lounge groups. People could not get the big bands because they weren't around and nobody was recording. But you could also get a few musicians that were not operating as much but lived in that city. They would form groups and go and play these smaller lounges, and I think that's where that thing was born.
I'm Avery Brooks, and this is Count Basie's World from NPR. In the end, nothing could insulate Count Basie from the discomfort of changing times and the pain of World War II. December 1943 brought the news of the death of his mentor, Fats Waller. Even more difficult for Basie was the beginning of the decline of the big band era. Gigs were harder to find, and Basie turned to small parts in films to help his finances some.
Open the door, Richard!
The post-war period would be a low ebb for Basie's band. Even novelties like Open the Door, Richard couldn't sustain Basie.
Open the door, Richard.
Open the Door, Richard peaked as the top hit in the country in 1947. It was so big that Louis Jordan's version of it also reached number 6 in the top 10 that year.
Open the door, Richard. Richard, why don't you open that door? Open the door, Richard!
Although it was a commercial success, Open the Door, Richard was a musical gimmick. Everyone knew it, including Basie. Although there were highlights, the times had changed his groove. Radio stations were no longer broadcasting him live. Record sales were way down. And by 1949, Basie was in crisis. Lauren Schoenberg is the director of the Jazz Museum of Harlem.
By the time that the band broke up in 49, things were really rough. This was a band that 7-8 years earlier had been at the top. And now, like all the bands, they were really scuffling. So he broke it into a small band.
Basie biographer.
The guy who was most unhappy with the little band was Billy Eckstein. He would give him hell. This is small potatoes, bass. You look funny up there. Get yourself a big band. You don't need this. Come on out on the road with me, son.
Eckstein had tried his hand with his own big band. As an incubator of bebop, it also struggled with commercial success. But the music of the Eckstein band was an indicator of the changing times. For his new band, Basie kept his focus and attracted some of the best musicians on the scene, including trumpeter Clark Terry, drummer Buddy Rich, and clarinetist Buddy DeFranco. Buddy DeFranco remembers his first day with Basie.
Clark and I were contemporaries in 1950 when we joined Basie's band. And the first rehearsal I will never forget because Clark and I had abundant technique on our instruments, both of us. And we both wanted to show off. So we did. Practically the first song we played everything we could imagine into the first song, and enough for three symphonies. And Bill Basie stopped us. Said, "Whoa, wait a minute. We're going to get there. Honest, we're going to get there." He said, "Take it easy, not so many notes." And he started plunking at the piano the way he does. And before you know it, we got the idea. There it is. There's the tempo. There's the feeling.
Schoenberg.
It was a brilliant group, and they made wonderful records. But what happened was it was no longer that Basie idiom. They tailored the arrangement. They did Basie hits. Once in a while, the Basie thing kind of leaks through. But for the most part, these are three young musicians trying to come to terms with Charlie Parker, and that greatness of Basie and his idiom was kind of lost. And from that point on, the Basie thing became a whole different story, in many ways less modern, less improvisational than the great Basie band of the 1930s.
Billy Eckstein was right. The small group diminished Basie, and the band was out of business by 1952. But Basie was undeterred. Thank you. abandoning the nonchalant swing concept from the era of head arrangements, Basie hired Neil Hefti, Ernie Wilkins, and others to compose and arrange a fresh repertoire for a new big band. A supporting cast of musicians and vocalists was assembled to complement him. As a result, a new, refined Basie appeared. With his new team in place, there were places to go and music to make. The Basie Renaissance was about to begin, and some of his best days were just ahead. No longer able to depend on radio broadcasts to promote himself, Count Basie found a new ally in the fledgling medium of longer-playing sound recordings. Creative new charts from arrangers Neil Hefti and Ernie Wilkins provided Basie with a new repertoire that reflected the personalities, dynamics, and unique qualities of his new band members, and the audiences responded. In 1952, he signed a recording contract with producer Norman Granz. The Basie Band was back. Down for the Count, from the 1954 session, 16 Men Swinging, showcases the clean new Basie sound with the capable Joe Newman and Thad Jones in the trumpet section and Frank Foster and Frank Wess on tenor saxophone. The band was dynamic. Down for the Count, from the 1954 session, 16 Men Swinging. The band's new success paved the way for its first European trip, with stops in Copenhagen, Munich, and Paris. Trombonist Bill Hughes was there.
At that time, I mean, the world wasn't so accessible. It took us 13 hours to go over there on prop planes. We'd go up by way of Newfoundland and then jump across the ocean on a DC-6. The two cultures were totally divided. We were hearing all the foreign languages, and we were seeing people do things differently than they do them in the United States. We couldn't get a sandwich after about 12 o'clock at night.
In Europe, the reception for Basie was electrifying. The press had done its homework, and the audience was sophisticated. For Basie, it was an eye-opener. Drummer Louis Belson.
Going to Europe, they rolled out the red carpet. That's what they did for Duke and Basie and Dizzy and Bird and Oscar. And they came to listen. The audiences were in their corner. They knew what the music was, and they reacted. You got standing ovations, and you had to come back and play three or four encores because they knew they were listening to something great.
Back home, the Christmas season of 1954 was particularly good for Basie. He would get an unexpected Christmas present, one that would change his fate forever and help seal his place in jazz immortality. I'm Avery Brooks. We'll check that out and much more as Count Basie, the man and his music, continues. Basie never forgot his days with Jimmy Rushing, and when he heard Joe Williams, a blues and ballad singer, Basie knew he had his man. Trombonist Bill Hughes and saxophonist Frank Foster lived through the arrival of Joe Williams, Bill Hughes.
That was history. That was it. Joe Williams came at that particular moment, and that was history.
And the words of Count Basie and Joe Williams were magic. There was a guaranteed full house lines around the corner.
In 1955, young Elvis Presley signed with RCA Records. RCA may have had Elvis, but Count Basie had Joe Williams. And Presley, Basie, and Williams were some of the hottest names in music. With its driving groove and identifiable message, Ernie Wilkins' arrangement of Every Day I Have the Blues was an instant hit. And it made number two on the R&B charts in 1955. Bill Hughes.
Joe transformed this band from a great band that was working but not making a lot of money into a great band that was working and making a lot of money. That's how, you know, yeah. He really did that much because once we recorded Every Day and Rollin' Pete, that stuff seemed like it just hit all at once, you know. And all of a sudden, we were working in all these places, and the crowds were there, you know, and we were making money, and that Basie was happy, and the band was happy having fun.
Every day I have the blues. Every day I have the blues. Well, you see me worry, baby, because it's you I hate to lose. Nobody loves me. Nobody seems to care. Nobody loves me. Nobody seems to care. Speaking of bad luck and trouble, well, you know I've had my share.
Every Day I Have the Blues, Joe Williams and Count Basie. From May 1955 on, Count Basie records would find their way into homes all over the world. It was just a matter of months before a Vernon Duke tune arranged by Wild Bill Davis would become Basie's next hit. Basie told the story to NPR's Susan Stamberg.
Tell me about the arrangement for April in Paris, which is just such a standard for you.
Wild Bill Davis did this. So we were working together at the Birdland. We were there together with Bill's group. And he played this thing so wonderful. I said, it would be wonderful if we could do this thing together. So we did it together, and it took off right away. So we decided to record it with Bill. But Bill didn't make the session. Something got wrong. We went and did it anyway, you know. I'm glad he didn't make it, too. Of course. I got to have that record.
Rest of Count Basie's life. Wherever he went, people would ask to hear Every Day I Have the Blues and April in Paris. It was a new identity for Basie, one that brought a huge new audience with it. In 1956, in the jazz polls and festivals, Basie was king. Metronome magazine. Count Basie, best band. Joe Williams, best male vocalist.
I've got a girl who lives up on a hill. I've got a real fine girl that lives up on a hill.
An appearance at the Newport Jazz Festival and a recording session for Roulette were highlights of 1957. With Neil Hefti arranging, the session entitled The Atomic Mr. Basie kept Basie in the stratosphere. It featured Whirly Bird. Little Darling. Arranger Neil Hefti played an important role in shaping the sound of the band, but it was the boss who had the last say, especially about tempos. Trumpeter Clark Terry.
When Neil Hefti was writing for the band, he brought in a tune and passed it out, and Basie played it. Basie shook his head. He said, what's the matter, you don't like the arrangement, Chief? He said, well, what's wrong with it? He said, tempo. He brought it in to be a... The tune was about here. So he said, well, what do you think it should be about here? That was the tune. He heard it. Look at the results. If he had kept it up there, it'd just been another also-ran tune.
I'm Avery Brooks, and this is Count Basie's World from National Public Radio. In 1958, Basie was so popular that other jazz ensembles began to cover the music. Sing a Song of Basie featured Lambert Hendricks and Ross doing a rousing version of Basie's Every Day.
Every sun, every moon,
every way, everywhere, I get blues and don't care. I run away and hide, but find they follow me.
Count Basie had survived the decade of Elvis Presley and rock and roll, and he would survive the decade of the British invasion. The Beatles would dominate popular music, but Count Basie had an ally. It was inevitable. Their paths had been crossing for decades, and now the stage was set for the July 6, 1961 meeting of Duke Ellington and Count Basie. The Count meets the Duke would feature the two legends with their entire orchestras in the same studio at the same time with their entire orchestras. Singer Ella Fitzgerald and pianist Andre Previn examined the differences between the two giants.
Other than the fact that they both have terrific bands and that they were both marvelous pianists, I can't think of two more opposites in character. How did that manifest itself? Did they run the band, not only musically, but personally, in a very different way?
I think they both loved music so much. To me, it was like a show every night when I worked with Duke, because you never knew what he was going to play. It was just beautiful. I'd come to work early, and the same way with Basie, there's nobody swings a band like Basie. I'm sorry.
Oh,
I'm just prejudiced.
Absolutely.
And, oh my gosh, you know, you come in early. You don't want to miss a lick, because he's got those tempos. That man can get tempos for you.
From the first notes of Battle Royal through the last notes of Jumpin' at the Woodside, this session was a once-in-a-lifetime affair. And it sounded like it. Ellington and Basie were a mutual admiration society, but they were also competitors, and a little friendly competition only made the music better. Pianist Oscar Peterson.
Here's a collaboration, if there ever was one. They were funny, and just to see them operating together. There was a certain distance between those two. It was a watch your cues now, he's here. I used to love to see them together. Different feelings, different thought process, and had great admiration for each other. Duke almost wanted certain things in his band to sound like certain things in Basie's band and vice versa. I believe this. They had that kind of admiration for each other. Basie's band could phrase together like no other orchestra that I know of. They take their breaths together, which is something I think most band leaders strive for. You know, let's play this together. That was the thing the band had that other bands didn't have. There's only one other band that could come close to it was Duke's band.
October 1962 was the date of the much-anticipated recording session with Basie and another 20th century American musical icon, singer Frank Sinatra.
I won't dance, don't ask me. I won't dance, don't ask me. I won't dance, madam, with you.
Sinatra's Reprise record label was in full swing, and Sinatra wanted Basie on his new label. For two high school dropouts from New Jersey who shared humble beginnings, this was an amazing moment. Pianist Oscar Peterson.
Well, I think Frank enjoyed Basie. I think if he had his druthers, he would have had him with him anytime he worked. The band would lay down a diagram for you to follow, and it was easy to read. Musically, rhythmically, harmonically. They didn't overreach themselves. They didn't overreach you. And I think Frank appreciated this.
Sinatra and Basie knew they were onto something special. They went on to record two studio albums and the stunning Sinatra at the Sands.
How did all these people get in my room?
Recorded live in Vegas with arranger Quincy Jones conducting.
Come fly with me, we'll fly away. If you can use some exotic booze, there's a bar in far Bombay. Come on, fly with me, we'll fly away.
Again, Oscar Peterson.
I'll be honest with you, I think Basie lifted Frank up. Frank had been singing with a different type of arranger and arrangement behind him. Then all of a sudden, he was presented with this different montage, which was the Basie band, and I think it brought a side of Frank that not too many of us knew.
With Sinatra, Basie strided the worlds of popular music and jazz, and he became a television personality. In the 70s, Basie looked for direction, and he found it in an old friend, producer Norman Granz.
With Basie, I could come up with a lot of ideas that were different from what Basie had done. After all, I didn't discover Basie. Basie was a developed band leader. But for me to have Basie do a small group with an organ or things of that sort, it gave him a different frame. If it worked, fine. If it didn't hurt Basie any, and he enjoyed doing them, you see. So, in that sense, I would involve myself.
Count Basie would spend the last decade of his life under the creative baton of Norman Granz. And it took him full circle back to his roots as the leader of a swinging rhythm section. Surrounded by old and new friends, Sweets Edison, Lockjaw Davis, Zoot Sims, and J.J. Johnson, Basie was open to just about anything, and he was having a ball. One of the most important sessions of this era was Satch and Josh, when Granz paired Basie with pianist Oscar Peterson.
I had doubts about how this was going to work when Norman called me about doing the album. But once I got in the studio, Basie took over. The first thing he did was put his finger in my face and say, "Now, you know, don't act up on me. Yeah, because I'll take care of you. Don't act up on me. You know, remember, I'm your friend, not your enemy." One of those things. It was a jovial thing. It was a love thing. It wasn't a competitive thing because we're two different players. Everybody knows that. He's the exact opposite of me and vice versa, pianistically and musically. He would play his chorus on something. I would try and back him as best I could because I loved what he did. And I would watch how much I played. I didn't want to overplay him. It was just a thing of love. It's very personal. I miss him terribly. I really do. He was a very gentle man. I wish I had a movie of Basie when he saw one of my children, when he was a baby. He was so gentle, it was almost like the Madonna with the Holy Child. He just held the baby as if it was glass, and he just oohed and aahed.
For over half a century, Count Basie stayed on the road to play music for his audience. In the end, it caught up to him. Drummer Duffy Jackson.
You're so pumped up from the adrenaline of meeting people and going to different places and enjoying the atmosphere of different places every night of your life. But if you take more than 2 or 3 days off, you totally collapse. We were about ready to take a 10-day break coming back from the Japan tour of 1980. And Basie was feeling so good at that time that he was afraid. He didn't want to take a 10-day break. So we went into 6 to 8 weeks of one-nighters, and that's what started to break him down physically. He really should have taken that time off to heal himself. The band was swinging so hard, he wanted to keep that momentum.
Musically and personally, Count Basie never stopped growing, but his health started to get the best of him. Regardless of his condition, he kept performing. He'd ride out in his electric cart and onto the piano bench, and he'd come to life. Louis Belson was Basie's drummer of choice during the last years.
I thought about Basie, because he wasn't feeling too good at that time. And I thought, wow, I wonder if the last time I recorded with Basie was the last time I'll ever be able to see him and hear him and feel that great pulse and listen to that wonderful voice and be able to climb into his world and be with him for a while. I didn't realize at the time that would be the end of it. But then I thought again, it's not the end of it because that music still has life, excitement, musicality, the whole thing. This is basic. Strong, healthy, beautiful, God-given. It's forever.
William Count Basie died April 26, 1984, at the age of 79. His was an American success story. He was a man who rose mightily from his humble youth in Red Bank, New Jersey, to become an American musical hero. In 1981, just 3 years before his death, Basie received the Kennedy Center Lifetime Achievement Award. His sound, the Basie sound, is forever etched into the history of jazz, America's cultural treasure. The story of his life is the story of a gentleman who surrounded himself with the best musicians of all time. He put the music first and never let anger get the best of him. I'm Avery Brooks.
The Count Basie Centennial Radio Project is produced by the Luce Group in association with WBGO-FM and National Public Radio. Jazz Profiles is a production of NPR. For more information, visit our website at npr.org. That's npr.org. Count Basie, the man and his music, was written and produced by Jim Luce. Our technical director is Duke Marcos. Special thanks to the Institute of Jazz Studies at Rutgers University, the Hamilton College Jazz Archives, the Mars Sound Archives at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, the Library of Congress, the Center for Jazz Studies at Columbia University, the American Jazz Museum, the Jazz Museum of Harlem, Tracy Turner Design, and to Cephas Bowles, Dan Morgenstern, Robert O'Mealy, Chase Jackson, Wiley Rollins, Monk Rowe, Brian Belanca, Larry Applebaum, Tad Hershorn, Ben Rowe, Samantha McElhaney, and Toby Byron Multiprizes. Major support for the Count Basie Centennial Radio Project comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the Hovland Company, America made audio for the home, at hovlandcompany.com. Aorus Automatic Mechanical Swiss Watches at aorus.ch. Small Dog Electronics, iPods and Apple Computers at smalldog.com. And Swiss International Airlines, 70 destinations worldwide at swiss.com. Support also comes from National Public Radio, the New Jersey Council for the Humanities, and the New Jersey Historical Commission. This is NPR, National Public Radio.